Hey, welcome back, everybody. Time once again from Trauma to Hope, a podcast about preventing trauma and healing lives with our two experts in that area, Rima Nashashibi, founder and president of Global Hope 365, and Dr. Estera Borska, CEO and founder of Teach, Train, Transform International. We'll call her Dr. B from now on. Dr. B and Rima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
We had some great comments on the last show. You had a woman, you haven't heard her, go back and listen to it. I forgot her name now already. Her Rima will remind me here.
But Paula.
And she was so blunt and eye-opening about the problems up in L.A. And we had several people comment. One in particular said,
Paula was the one who commented about the same thing happening in San Diego.
Oh.
And our speaker last time was Dr. Caroline Heldman.
That's right.
And Dr. Heldman talked to us, and I hope you joined us at the last podcast, but she talked to us about the child abuse, child sexual abuse at the three LA Juvenile Detention Center that has been going on for 50 years.
Wow.
There has been no accountability. There has been no investigation that we can see or think of, because our thing was release the records. So we've done many press conferences, multiple press conferences, and we've met, attempted to meet with elected officials. Somehow they didn't want to meet us, all of them.
Imagine
because,
that.
Yes, because what we said is release the records. If you've done the investigation, if you've held those perpetrators accountable, if they're not being paid by the taxpayers' money still, we need to know. And so far, there has been no records released. And one elected officials who basically introduced legislation to hold the perpetrators accountable and protect survivor rights is now flipping to the other side. And what they're doing is they're trying to make it much harder for survivors. They're trying to introduce legislation that will make it much harder for the for survivors to prove that they were sexually abused at public
facility.
Yes, yeah. Public facilities. Thank you, Estera. Thank you. And it, the threshold will go from 50 to 75% if they're successful.
So the only reason I brought it up, one, to remind people what you're talking about, and two, urging to go back and hear them. The comments that we got, one of them I said to Dr. B about this, and I'm paraphrasing, but one of the persons said, what a powerful presentation. I wish I had the nerve to listen to all of it. In other words, they almost had to cover their ears. They couldn't believe what they were hearing.
Yep.
And she said, I'm going to have to go back and listen to this again.
Yes.
It was so shocking what you were talking about that they couldn't listen to the whole, they couldn't absorb
right.
it all in one listening here. I think that may be one of the themes we're facing today. Today, what are you going to talk about? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. So today, we're going to talk about breaking the silence, another silence, hope beyond sextortion. And so let's explain what sextortion is. Sextortion is when, let's say, for example, teens, because at Global Hope 365, we go to schools, colleges, and universities, and we say, here's the facts, here's the red flags, don't become a victim. And so in Orange County, we'll start with Orange County, since we are in Orange County, the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force issued a report in 2023 and in 2025. So 2023 covered the 2 years before that. So,
yeah.
And then 2025 covered 23 and 24. And the percentage of minors in the 2023 report to the total number of human trafficking victims was 36%.
Wow.
Is that high?
Yes.
However, the percentage of minors in the 2025 report went up to 50%, Dr. B.
Yeah.
And mainly the increase is mainly due to sextortion, which means a teen or young adult has sent a nude pictures of themselves, which is a crime by itself, although it's their own picture, it's a crime.
Crime.
And then they were extorted financially, put into sex trafficking or both. And now there's crime syndicates that are jumping in the mix because it's very easy to sextort these teens and young adults. And they start, the teen would be online, and then a cute young girl or a cute young boy,
right,
will approach you. And you'll see this cute picture, and you'll think that's the person behind.
That's the person
behind.
I'm sending the picture to.
Yes, when it's actually could be a 50-year-old male.
Yep.
And she will start with the crime syndicates. They will send them the nude pictures on themselves first so they feel comfortable. And then so they send theirs. And as soon as they send theirs, they're extorted financially within an hour or two. And some of these teens have committed suicide because they couldn't pay, right? Yeah. They couldn't pay anymore. And they were ashamed to go tell their parents.
Yeah.
And so
and just that fear, yeah, the fear of being outed.
Right.
Will cause you to give money to, that's how they get lured into human trafficking, mm-hmm, and doing other acts, not just the pictures. Now they've been lured into this manipulation. Right. Awful.
So, Dr. B, would you explain to us first the trauma that teen or young adult goes through, and then the trauma of the whole family, yeah, whether the teen has committed suicide, which we know some of them have, or if they came to them, and usually, and they said, this is what happened to me, and I need help. And usually when I do presentations to parents, guardians, and teachers and say, you need to discuss dangers online with your children.
Yes.
And just like there's dangers in person, stranger danger, there's also dangers online. You need
Absolutely.
To be aware of these things. And if anything happens, you need to come to me. There'll be no shaming. There'll be no blaming. We're here to help you and protect you.
Yeah. Just that last sentence you said alone really talks about the root of the problem. Is creating a sense of safety for your children so that they welcome they're coming to you with difficult things.
Okay.
And I think a tool that I think parents can use that it's so powerful is always create an environment where your children can come and talk to you about anything. Create an environment where they can say hard things to you, especially around some of these topics, because there's so much shame around it. I did something bad. I've sent something now that exposed my entire family, and we're in this hard situation. And so the youth often goes to just having severe mental health issues and even suicide because they see no way out. There's no way I can tell my parents that I did this awful thing because of the deep shame that they feel. And then also, they don't have that relationship maybe with the parent or feel
right.
like I can't, it's not safe for me to tell them I'm going to be in trouble or this will happen or that will happen. And so there's cultural factors that come into play around these heavy topics, such as around sexual topics. I'm uncomfortable. We've never had that conversation. I had a young teen who was dealing with something similar, and he said, you don't understand why I couldn't share this with my parents. Because if something happens, if we're watching a TV show with my dad and someone kissing, I run. How could I ever share that I allowed this to happen? There was this attractive young guy that I thought used to go to my high school, because that's how he lured this young girl. As he told her, I remember you. I know you from somewhere. I used to go to your high school. I remember you. And so because of the things she put online, he knew markers. The manipulation started. Mm. Oh, I know this friend. You know this person? It's because he saw them on her social media. So he used familiarity to lure her. And so she said, it was impossible for me to not feel the deep shame to be able to say that to my dad. I felt like I would rather die than say that to my dad and say I did this. So the deep shame causes, so that's the trauma. The big part of it is these kids probably already vulnerable, already experienced some trauma before, already feel this deep-rooted shame, because we talk a lot about trauma being this aspect of holding a sense of identity that is rooted in hurt and trauma and the brokenness of other people. So if you already have that and then something like this happens, it just takes you deeper into the hole.
Let's backtrack a bit for the audience who hasn't joined us before.
Yes.
Can you tell us about your background,
yes,
Dr. B?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit about my background. I have an organization called Teach, Train, Transform International, and I do intense mental health work and really help teach people about trauma in the brain. And I feel like we've stigmatized mental health so much and made it an illness. It's about medication. It's about diagnosing, that we forget that we all have a mental health. The same way we have a physical health, we have a mental health, we have a spiritual health. And so learning how to store our mental health every day is very important, especially to teach that to children. So some of my work is really around teaching people about the brain, teaching people about how it works, teach neuroscience tools to say, here's how our brain holds trauma over time. And so since we were children, what we really understand trauma to be might not actually be the root of trauma. It might be simple things, like you try to show your art project to your parent and they were too busy, or they shunned you away, or nobody talked about anything in the home. And there was like very little conflict and no one talked about the elephant in the room, if you will. And so those things children will hold and say, maybe there's something wrong with me. Mm. I can't keep my parents happy. They become responsible for other people's feelings and the home, and those become the real traumas, right?
I see.
And they become vulnerable. So that's part of the work I do, is just to teach how to really break apart from other people's brokenness. And instead of, I think so much therapy these days is just processing of trauma, right? Which just means to acknowledge it. It's not enough to acknowledge it. We have to be able to say what caused it. Recently, I had a young woman who came to me and she was profusely crying. And she said, please help me. I don't know how to get out of this pattern because I've had 5 narcissistic relationships in the last 6 years.
Wow.
And she started young, even as a teen. And it was around this aspect of being lured into really toxic relationships and human trafficking by this person she trusted, who she thought was her boyfriend. And so I had to look her in the eyes, right? And as she asked me that deep question of, how did I get here? How did they choose me? How did I choose them? How did we find each other? Why is it that I keep falling in this pattern? And I basically had to look her in the eyes and say, it's because that's what you believe you deserve. And she started profusely crying and said, that is exactly what happened. She said, I realized a big part of that was my own father and always wanting his attention and not getting it correctly because he was wounded as a child and never dealt with that. So he was emotionally unavailable. And so I think that's unintentionally and even subconsciously is what I look for. I look for that validation, that love, that support from him. And so it's not enough to acknowledge that. You have to go to the second step of healing, which is saying, how do I break that pattern? What did it cause in me?
How do we break that pattern?
We have to be able to break that pattern by acknowledging. So there's an analogy I like to use, okay?
Okay.
Follow me here for a second.
We'll try.
Yeah, analogy of just the sink. So if we want to wash our face in a sink, it's not enough to acknowledge the sink is broken, right? So sometimes it's acknowledging those deep-rooted things from our childhood, needs that were not met, realizing that maybe we really struggled in something or didn't get those needs met, because research shows we're supposed to be told 10 to 12 times a day that we're okay and safe in the world. I don't know about your childhood, but I never got that. I don't think any of us have. So it shows that there's needs that are unmet there. So when our brain is fully developed as an adult, we have to go back and retranscribe our childhood. But back to the sink analogy, okay, so we wash our face in the sink. We want to wash our face in the sink. Acknowledging the sink is broken is the first step. That's the processing of trauma, getting out of denial, saying this happened to me. The second step of healing is where we stop and get stuck. That's why people carry their trauma wounds for 20 plus years. And so the second step to healing is saying, what did it cause in me? Maybe it caused me to look for external validation. Maybe it caused me to be a people pleaser. I struggle with boundaries. I realize I'm a perfectionist, or I'm very controlling and rigid, or right, acknowledging what did it cause in me? What is the wound that it caused?
Can't we go to a sink that's not broken?
You could. And then you find out that sink is broken too. That's hilarious. But yeah, that you have to be, okay, now we have to understand the part of the sink that's broken is maybe the faucet, but it's still not enough, because acknowledging the faucet is broken, you still can't wash your face in it, right? So you have to be able to replace it and remodel. So that remodeling phase is the most important part of trauma work, which is you have to replace the old narratives, the old storylines, and rewire the brain. So maybe as a kid, I always thought I wasn't good enough and not lovable. Okay. I carry this deep, dark wound. And so we think, we often look at affirmation. So a tool I'm going to teach today at the end of our podcast is called the neuroaffirmation. And we think that if we haven't felt beautiful or good enough for a whole life, we can go in the mirror and say, I'm lovable, I'm beautiful, I'm smart. But it's very hard for it to stick. But if we identify, give evidence to our brain and rechange those thoughts and reframe them with the truth, I often say the truth will set us free. Okay. And so when we provide our brain the evidence, it'll rewire with a new story.
So let's go to another type of trauma.
Okay.
As Global Hope 365, our mission, which is my nonprofit, by the way, if you're just joining us.
Rima does amazing work in her nonprofit. Follow her work.
Thank you. Our mission is to end harmful practices towards women and girls, such as child marriage, human trafficking, and other forms of gender-based violence.
Yes.
But most people, which shocked me, didn't know, and that's including myself, that child marriage was legal in the U.S. When we first started to raise awareness about it, it was legal in 48 out of the 50 states.
Wow.
Now it's legal, and that was in 2019. Now, 2026, it's legal in 33 states still. And in 3 states, there is 0 minimum age.
Wow.
And one of those states is California. So in California, all what you need is parental consent / coercion and judicial approval. So in the U.S., between 2000 and 2021, we had 315,000 minors that were married in the U.S. 86% were girls married to adult men. 85% of those marriages end up in divorce.
Of course, yeah.
Here's the sad part. Most of those marriages, forced marriages, because of the age differential and the power differential,
of course,
the girl, the young woman, end up being a victim of domestic violence. And if they go to a shelter, most shelters, I haven't seen one yet, will not accept them because they're under 18. So there's liability issues and there's laws. And so they don't accept
them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then if they go to a runaway shelter, they're married and have kids. So some of the survivors said they had to basically live on the streets with their kids.
Wow.
And they have to earn money every day to basically be able to stay in a hotel room.
Wow.
So Sherry Johnson, that's one case, and then I want to ask you about that trauma, out of Florida. She was repeatedly raped by a deacon in the church when she was, I think it started when she was 8. And when she was 10, she got pregnant. And so child welfare was going to conduct an investigation. So the church and her parents basically got together and they married her off to the rapist.
Wow.
And so at 10, 11, you're basically living with someone, let's say, in an apartment. You can't drive a car. You can't rent anything. You cannot sign a contract until you're 18.
It's awful.
Yes. And you don't know what your rights are, right?
Yeah.
And then when she was 18, she found a friendly attorney and she got a divorce because you cannot sign a contract, which is the divorce, until you're 18. And so guess how many kids does she have?
3.
7.
Oh.
So would you explain to us the trauma, the mental, we're going to have a guest that's going to go over the physical trauma, but the mental trauma that a 10-year-old who's been raped and forced to marry her rapist and then has 7 kids and then at 18 has to get a divorce, what kind of a mental trauma does this young female has and how can they overcome it? Sherry Johnson did a good job with advocating to end that in Florida with other organizations, and they were able to advocate and pass legislation that said no child marriage under 17, no exceptions. What we want is no child marriage under 18, no exceptions.
Yeah, and even 18-year-olds, you think about an 18-year-old is very difficult to be even ready for marriage, even at 18. But you think about the vulnerability of a child, and let's just go directly to brain science, right? Mm-hmm. Our brain is not fully developed until we're like
25, 26.
Yeah, when we're in our early 20s, right? And for men, it's a little bit longer because they take longer to cook. So when you think about this young girl and the life that she lived at 10 years old, so what we... When we come out of our mother's womb, the first thing we understand is intuition. Our amygdala, or the front part of our brain, is what is connected first, because we need to feel, we feel neuroception, which is basically threat and safety. And everything we translate through safety and threat and what feels dangerous and not, and through intuition. And so for a 10-year-old, that's the developmental age that is most important, because we learn the most about ourselves. The most development happens. You start to look over your shoulder and compare and understand, learn to separate.
Where at what age is that?
Like the preteen, like 10 to 11, 12.
Okay.
And so it's the most crucial time. So I can't even imagine for a 10-year-old who doesn't even have a fully developed brain, not even halfway there. It's a really scary thought, because in that age group, the needs are to feel safe, to have a parent that they go to feel safety, to feel security. And so the amount of trauma. So that's really important too, because if we interviewed her, she was here in our podcast right now. If we try to help her understand the dynamic of everything that she went through, she couldn't come up with a million events of trauma that happened during this. That wasn't even a marriage. I can't even consider that a marriage. Right. It was an abusive relationship. And so in that abuse that she incurred with this man, sexual and otherwise every other type of trauma, the events are important. But between that and seven children until she was 18 years old, there's so many that you can't even count. The way the brain works and holds trauma is not by the events that happen in that relationship of 8 years and seven kids. The way she holds it is him. He is the culprit. And all the people around it that allowed that to happen. Her parents who let her down, the disappointment, the hurt, the betrayal, all of that. So I call that the skeletons in the closet of our mind. Because the way our brain holds trauma is by the people. We categorize the people who have wronged and hurt us even more the events. So we'd have to find a way through that and separate his brokenness from her and help her acknowledge that wasn't my fault. I was just a kid. I was a poor, vulnerable kid trying to survive a bad environment. It wasn't my fault, because the real trauma is not what he did to her or what she had to survive, but it's all the messages she must have told herself as a kid, not understanding that, not conceptualizing all that hurt and pain. Probably said to herself horrible things like, I'm not good enough. I'm not loved. I'm a horrible person, right? My parents don't love me. They let me go to this awful man, right? So we'd have to be able to undo and retell those stories, rewire her brain with the truth, which is, it wasn't my fault. I was a poor, vulnerable kid trying to survive a bad environment. I have to separate his brokenness from me, my parents who let me down, all the other people in our community, in our church. How awful that it's around. There's so many different themes here. We could spend hours talking about it, but that's what I would help her hear. I would help her heal all the people around that hurt.
It seems we have a question. We have a call.
We haven't called yet, but we're going to put out a notice if somebody does want to call. Not just on the screen. We want to tell people that you can join in this conversation in the last 15 minutes of each episode.
Awesome.
Where we let you ask questions, as I did last week. Call that number on the screen, 949-824-1200. And please be patient, because it's just me answering them one at a time. It's not a massive network here. But operators are standing by, meaning me. 949-824-1200. You can actually come on air and ask a question, or you can always, of course, try tweeting or send.
No, basically, we do have a Facebook page, and we also have an Instagram page, and they can put their questions there.
And if not this week, next week we'll answer other things.
So,
we'll see if that. I had a question while this is going on.
Yes.
So you just casually say that this poor girl's abused, she's 11, and the parents, you just casually say, and the parents marry her off. Why in God's name would they marry their 11-year-old to this man who abused their daughter? Why?
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
For both of us. What do you think, Reba?
And actually, the three attempts to end child marriage under 18, no exceptions, in California have failed miserably.
Which is shocking in and of itself. Yeah. You would think long ago this would have been the law of the land.
Okay, so basically Senator Jerry Hill introduced Senate Bill 273. I'm getting technical here.
Yeah, don't tell us. We want to know. We need these laws to change.
And the reason he did is because he had a constituent come to him who's a high schooler. And she said, my friend is being forced to marry. I didn't think that was legal in the U.S., and let alone California, a very progressive state. How can we end this? And he said, that's a no-brainer. Let's introduce legislation. However, it failed. And unfortunately, the second attempt was with Senate Bill 404 by freshman Senator Aisha Wahab. And that failed also. Then in 2024, Assemblywoman Kari Petrie Norris, which we've worked with her in the past.
A local Orange County.
Yes. We've worked with her in the past because one of the arguments in order not to let these legislation pass is that you don't have data. We didn't have data in California because California and 21 other states didn't keep statistics of children getting married.
Of course.
You think they would, right? But what Senate Bill 273 did, although it failed to end child marriage under 18, no exception, it said California now has to keep statistics of minors getting married. So it was exciting, right?
That's great.
So we went the next year, January 2020, and we said, because it went into effect 1/1/2019. We said, give us the report, please. We went to the state. They gave us the report. There wasn't much data into it, so which was surprising. So we went and did our own research to the various larger counties. And some of them said, yeah, we have the data, but the state didn't ask us for it. And so we went to the state and we said, that's what they're saying. And they said, the state said, we don't have to ask them for it. It's the law. They have to supply it. They have to supply us with
it. But I go back to my first question. Why would a parent, any parent in their right mind, find out their daughter's being abused at 11 and decide the best choice is to marry them to this abuser?
Because we do have, it's a patriarchal society. And there we go back to the shame. And some, the other thing would be, the parents may be charged with child neglect and child abandonment.
Their own fear.
So this covers up the crime.
Yes. And the 315,000, it was before 300,000 that were married between 2000 and 2018, and the figure went up, right, by 2020. 60% of the 300,000, it would have been a sex crime, which is statutory rape. So the marriage is a get-out-of-jail-free card for the rapist.
To protect themselves and the community.
Yes.
And to hide the shame and protect the parents, maybe. And
yes, yes.
I'd rather give this, my daughter, to this, and then to be able to feel the shame and allow our community to be embarrassed and feel the shame of that, or even our family, our
and
own family
unit. And perhaps face prosecution for letting it happen.
Let me explain one. Let me share a scenario with you. And a survivor of child marriage, her parents split, and then the father with the stepmom decided to leave the state to start a business, but they already paid for 1 year of private schooling for the child, for their daughter. So the dad and the stepmom decided they don't want to lose that money. So the stepmother brings in a friend who's 38, a male, to stay in the house with the 11-year-old kid. Yes, and that's exactly
what
happened.
Leave the child behind, and hopefully they think in the custody, the care of somebody they can trust.
So basically, she was molested between 11 to 13. Oh. And when she got pregnant, they called the parents. The parents came in, and of course, she was forced to marry her rapist.
Wow.
And so that's just one scenario.
Yeah. There's so many stories. And we're going to go over so many different stories and survivor stories. And this coming episode, we're going to have an email too that you can write in your stories and everything else. We'll go over the structure at the end here. But to answer Paul's question, I agree with you that it's so much about the deep shame of the community, of trying to protect from the legal aspects of it as well, and trying to put a band-aid on the situation and their own brokenness. A lot of...
But what's more important? Is it the life of my daughter or my life and my shame?
It shows the unhealed, the unhealed version of our of ourselves, right? So what you don't heal, you repeat. This is exactly what intergenerational trauma is. The parents usually had their own traumas and hurts they haven't healed, so
but
they don't.
That doesn't excuse what they did.
It's not never an excuse, but explanation that helps heal to understand, because it's hard to think about how can someone, a parent who has a small child, that allow that to happen. And for especially for the child who went through that, who's now an adult suffering that trauma, they need to be able to separate their own parents' brokenness from them, realize that was a part of the stuff they haven't healed. That is about them, so that they can heal that in their heart, so they're not holding that deep hurt and resentment that is going to carry them their whole life.
So part of the name of the show is From Trauma to Hope. We've spent a long time talking about trauma, as we always do. Give us some hope at the end here.
Yes. Yeah, we're gonna learn a little tool here before we end. So
I did receive a question. I'll share it with you after you're done.
No, let's do it. We have a little bit of time. We have 7-8 minutes left, so let's do it.
So the question was, how can we hold these parents accountable? Because then that would prevent future victims.
Absolutely. So I'm really glad you asked me that question. No, did we get that question from someone in our chat too? Awesome. So that is such an important question, because it basically talks about the most important thing I want to achieve in my career. I wanted to be able to get this thing called the Circle of Security framework and my own version of it into the hospitals, into prenatal care, into new parents, and to parents as teens, because that we need to understand the unmet needs of children, the emotional needs of children, and what it truly means to give a child emotional well-being, to help them to be raised, to have good emotional intelligence, and really help them to raise children that are well-balanced and emotionally well. And parents need to know that. It needs to start from the beginning. It's a prevention matter. I know a lot of the work that you do is prevention and awareness. Right. And that is such an important part, because before we even get to the trauma, the prevention part is so important. The teaching people how to store, how to raise healthy children, how to be healthy themselves. So I would definitely say we need to be able to teach parents what that means, how to heal their own stuff, so it doesn't carry to the next generation.
Actually, I was hoping that one of the survivors will sue their parents for the trauma.
From the legal aspect.
Yes.
Yes.
For the trauma they went through. Because but for the parents signing off on them to get married at 11 or at 16 to a 26 or at 14 to a 40-year-old, then they wouldn't have to go through.
Is there a possible precedent with what I've seen happen regarding school shootings, where some of these parents are now being held accountable for putting guns into their kids' hands, particularly if the kid exhibited violence and whatnot beforehand?
You're going to open a can of worms at the end of our show here?
No, it's our show, Paul.
I know, but I'm just saying.
It's our show.
I get you. But I'm just saying there's other precedents out there where parents should be held accountable. Right. Yeah.
That's a great topic, and I definitely want us to cover that, because there's so much to say about that, and we're going to get to it. We should do a whole show on that, Rima.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. But can you tell us, what is that tool? Let's go back to that tool.
Let's get that tool, and then we can end with telling them a little bit about the structure of our podcast. So I want to teach what I call a neuroaffirmation. So we often talk about the word affirmation a lot in our field and say you affirm yourself in a positive way, stand in front of the mirror and say, I'm beautiful, I'm beautiful, I'm beautiful, I'm smart, right? But it's very hard when your brain has tons of evidence and negative thoughts and patterns that have already been created and automatic thoughts deep in our subconscious. So the way that I go around that is called a neuroaffirmation.
Okay.
And what you do is you say a negative thought. So I don't know, tell me a negative thought, Rima, anything. Anything that maybe you've heard from victims, survivors, your own thought, anything.
Yeah, why can't I lose weight?
I like that one. I can't lose weight. That's a good one, right? So instead of saying, I can lose weight, looking in the mirror and saying that, what I'd like you to do is tell me three truths that are also true within that negative thought, three other possibilities of thinking. So three other truths. So what is also true about you losing weight? Have you lost weight in the past?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So that's one of them. When I think I can't lose weight, I've lost weight in the past.
Yes.
What else is the truth about that?
You feel good about yourself.
Yeah, I feel good about myself when I do. And what is the last one?
Now, help me with that one.
Yeah, it could be, I know what it takes, right? If I take good care of myself and sleep well and drink more water, I know what it takes to lose the weight. I need time and effort. Most people think, I struggle with that too, right? But most people think that it's all the food and stuff, but sometimes I need to give time and energy to my health.
But, you know, having to deal with those issues that we deal with day in and day out, which is the trauma, the child marriage and the trauma associated with it, the sex trafficking, the labor trafficking, which we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
And so when you're dealing with that day in and day out, it becomes part of you. Now, my way of trying to get out of that trauma is walk. I like to walk. What else can I do?
Yeah. So the neural affirmation is the reflective part. So walking, I'm actually glad you brought that in. We need to do a whole segment on that. It's like coping skills are things that help you physically get rid of the stress, the angst, the trauma. Okay. Walking, take a hot shower, cold shower, go for a walk, go for a jog, talk to someone, get a massage, right? Like all those things are great.
Okay.
They'll help with the physical sensations of the stress or breathing. Amazing nervous system regulation. But after that 50-minute massage is over, the same stress exists. Your work stress is still there, right? And it's still going to cause issues. So what you want to do is do a reflective practice. So the neuroaffirmation is helping you think deeper about it, right? And I'll teach tons of tools that are reflective practices. But it's basically saying, here's this negative thought that keeps coming up. And it's those failed attempts around the weight loss I can't do. But now I have three other possibilities, three other truths that exist. I've done it before.
It made me
I made me feel good. And also, it made me feel good. And the last thing we said was, I know what to do.
Okay.
I know what to do, right? I need to focus time and energy to it.
Okay.
And so if you write that on a post-it, write it in your phone everywhere and repeat that, our brain, the hippocampus, will, the more repetition you give to that new storyline, every time you think that negative thought of, I can't lose weight, now you've connected three neural pathways to that thought. So every time you try to think negative, you're also thinking those three positives. But I can't do it. But I do feel good when I do it. And I also know what to do.
Okay.
And so that's part of a reflective practice.
Okay. Right? So we have a minute left. Can you tell us about, you and I have talked about this, and we also talked about, we want to ask our audience to share their stories with us.
Yes, absolutely. Rima and I wanted to end our show with just giving you a little bit of structure for what our show is going to be like. This is our third show. We're so glad you guys are here listening in. So we're always going to, we might have a guest. Some weeks we will not have guests, just like today, and it'd just be Rima and I talking about an important topic, talking about the legal aspects of it and also the trauma aspects of it and healing. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a guest. Sometimes we might not. And then we will always talk about, we're always going to end and have some time to talk about the healing. And I promise to always teach a tool. Today we learned neuro affirmation, right? And also we will have an email that we promise to get to you guys by our next episode. So that way, not just on social media, but you can actually send an email that Rima and I will review together before our show. If you want to share your story,
It's more private, it's more personal.
Correct. Yes.
It doesn't have to go on social media for everybody to see.
To see, exactly. So share your personal stories. We don't have to share them on the air. They can be anonymous. We just want to connect with you. We want to engage. Rima and I are really busy women. But we do this because of the love for the healing, for the love of the people we serve.
We want to raise awareness.
Exactly. The people we serve, we want to raise awareness.
Yes.
We want to prevent these crimes from happening. And so engage with us. Tell us your stories. Tell us what's on your heart. Ask any questions. We're really doing this show on OC Talk Radio
for
that.
And invite us to speak at your school, colleges, schools, colleges, as universities, and community-based organizations and corporations, because I've done that in the past where we talk about the facts, the red flags, so they can protect their children.
And how do we do that then? How do they reach you, Rima and Dr. B? We'll start with Rima first.
They can reach us at Rima, R-I-M-A, at globalhope365.org.
Awesome. And you can reach me at AsteraBorska.com.
And let's spell the last name, because you flip the letters from how you say it.
I do.
I stumble every time I
start to say it. Estera, E-S-T-E-R-A, B-O-R-C-S-A.com.
So it's spelled CSA, but it's pronounced SCA.
That's right.
Yes.
Not confusing.
Thank you, everyone, for spending your time with us.
And thank you for joining us, and hope you'll share this with others as well here.
Thank you.
There you have it. There is a show now that helps you highlight, create awareness, and prevention, and ultimately hope. It's called From Trauma to Hope, and it's right here on Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Blind Innovation Center.